Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program is also sponsored by the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair. Our program today is Politics, the Environment, and National Security with Dr. Lewis Schubert. Dr. Schubert is professor of political science in the Social Science Department at City College of San Francisco. Dr. Schubert received his PhD from USC, University of Southern California, and he is the co-author of the textbook, The Irony of Democracy, the 17th edition, by the way, which will be out in December. Now, I'd be with great pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Schubert.
Thank you. I want to thank Ann for making this possible and inviting me. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and all of its members for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk to everybody about this, what I find is one of the more fascinating topics out there in the world of politics. The topic is in politics, and specifically the politics of environment and of security. Many people might think that the environment and national security are opposing narratives, that these are different ways of viewing the world. Not so in reality. There is a conflict over the discourse or the language to talk about environmental security. There's even a conflict over whether or not it's even a legitimate concept. However, this debate over the words and language are really just hindering action and ultimately contributing to insecurity. This evening, what I want to do is explore this concept, this debated concept of environmental security with you, and hopefully seek a solution. So, to start, environmental security is the idea that a complete definition of security has to include environmental factors. Or perhaps to drill it down even more specific, the idea that national security is incomplete without incorporating environmentally related security threats. This seems pretty straightforward, but there is a debate. And the debate is not so much over whether or not there is such a thing, there is a debate over whether such a thing should exist. Okay? Environmental security is a hybrid between two very different discourses, which have very different languages, very different views of the world, different assumptions, goals, and strategies for how to deal with questions of security and insecurity. So, environmental security will get criticized from all sides. Broadly, one side is concerned that the incorporation of environment into national security will dilute traditional security and make things less safe. The other side fears the militarization of environment and environmental protection, and in fact is quite distrustful of the very institutions of national security. They see them as part of the problem, not the solution. For each, the concept of environmental security does not fit preconceptions about theory or practice. Tonight, I'm going to try to mediate this debate between the two sides. To do this, I'm going to use gender theory. I want to help understand the starting point of each of these two perspectives and look from there to solutions. I believe that each side can be clarified by connecting it to its implicit or explicit gender-constructed worldview. Without getting all essentialist, what I want to do is use a common pop culture language. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. This is the language we use. There is the god of war versus the goddess of love. There's conflict versus cooperation, force versus nature. The traditional national security discourse is easily seen as a masculinist construction. It is the narrative of the warrior. It is big man thumping chest to protect the helpless. It is about physical threats that are countered with physical responses. strength and dominion are, quote, male attributes. Just picture quotes throughout all of this, okay? And male responsibilities. In contrast, the environmental and human security discourse is self-described as a more feminine construction and has values focusing on cooperation and inclusion and nurturing. This is cast as feminine, not just because of its self-definition, but because it also very clearly defines itself against the older male narrative of security. So what happens with environmental security is it generates a sort of cognitive dissonance, a discomfort that gets caused by contradiction, which can lead even thoughtful and very well-intentioned persons to feel the need to perhaps berate and belittle that which doesn't fit into a neatly gendered conceptual framework. But we are lucky. We have available greater resources that we can use to address these debates. These debates are characterized by contested gender constructions, so I will call our two approaches here, one, a looking at actual reality, and the second is queer theory. Environmental security does not conform to gendered narratives. It blurs the boundaries. It doesn't fit in traditional military theory. It doesn't fit into traditional ecological thinking. It is a conceptual hermaphrodite, okay? It has both. It's not neither, it's both simultaneously. It is as queer a concept as we're ever going to be able to find. The gendered debate, I believe, is a distraction. It's a power contest over rhetorical control. I would like to think that we can get past the debate over the narrative and get on with actually looking at security and the issues of security that could help people as well as this planet that is the home for all of our activities. So since it's the reference point, I'm going to start with traditional security or traditional national security. This is usually called the freedom from physical harm. Sorry, I'm going to start moving here. That's straightforward. Physical threat, what kinds of things? Invasion, attack, terrorist bombings, things like that. In addition, traditional national security is about the freedom of the fear of such attacks. In other words, it can also just be the perception. Insecurity can be physical or it can be perceptual. This leads to a national security approach that is frequently proactive and not reactive. It allows for action before there is conclusive proof. Deterrence, scenario building, what-if scenarios. The mechanism through which traditional security is done is the nation state, since 1648. This looks like an old restaurant. What a nation is a group of people with shared culture and values, and in this case, specifically a shared framework for understanding security concerns. Different peoples, different nations will have different understandings of what is security or what is insecurity. The connection of environment to traditional military security is ancient. We can talk about resource wars as far back as we have written history of warfare. There are conflicts over scarce resources. Sometimes the conflict is blatantly obvious what they're fighting about. Other times it's a little less clear, but you can trace it back. In 1798, Thomas Malthus wrote about the likelihood, he felt the definite future of conflict as people saw an increasing population and fewer resources to share. In 1999, a man named Thomas Homer Dixon wrote what I believe is the definitive work on environmental security with empirical evidence showing the link between environmental scarcity and violent conflict. We also see in the history of environmental and security the use of scorched earth tactics, which is pretty anti-environmental, but we're looking at the linkage between environment and security. A scorched earth tactic is trying to deny the adversary the ecological support that they need. A good example is the United States and Vietnam, where we used Agent Orange and other means to defoliate a significant part of that country to deny the Viet Cong the ecological support that they needed. And to be fair, the Viet Cong used the environment as a shield to protect them from attack. The idea of this being a problem already shows up in 1949. There's a protocol to the Geneva Convention in 1949 that prohibits methods of warfare that are going to damage the natural environment. So this is not a fresh new concept. There's also a record of the military having positive roles regarding the environment. Now, this one sometimes makes people think, and here's a way to approach it. If attacking the environment makes military sense because of the support role the environment has for human activity, wouldn't defending the environment on the same grounds make equal sense? So the military now has both an attack and defense function. I went through an insane number of possible examples to try to illustrate this. I've decided on a single one. And his name is Philip Henry Sheridan. He was a general in the 1800s, career U.S. Army, started off in California and Oregon, did some of the original survey work on the Willamette Valley. He's most famous for his role in the Civil War in November, December 1864, when he was responsible for essentially destroying the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. His orders to his soldiers were to destroy anything that could be of value to the enemy, and they did. They destroyed plants, they destroyed livestock, they destroyed orchards. It was as scorched earth as one can ever see. The reason? To deny the ecological support to the Confederate enemy. Sheridan's career continues. In the 1870s, he's now in charge of the Army of the West. And there the issue is dealing with a variety of First Nations, or Native Americans, if one prefers that term. His troops are ordered to become buffalo hunters. He says, destroying buffalo is destroying the Indians' commissary. This shows now an even more sophisticated understanding of the ecological relationship between those nations there and the environment that they depended on. So the linkage continues. And Sheridan has one more, and this is the one that I think clinches it, at least for me. In 1882, Sheridan visits Yellowstone Park. He is upset by the illegal poaching, illegal mining, and illegal logging going on. He's a pretty famous guy. He's a pretty well-connected guy. He lobbies Congress to expand Yellowstone, add to the game preserves, and to assign the Army to protect it. 1894, the Lacey Act places the U.S. Army in charge of Yellowstone. Basically, 15 stations of cavalry are put into Yellowstone. The poachers had guns. The Army had more. The result was the buffalo was basically saved, elk was saved as species that were going to be able to live in that area, and the park itself was able to survive to where we see it today. In a related story, but separate, without Sheridan, Yosemite National Park was basically being decimated by the politicians of the state of California. Illegal logging, the presence of 100,000 sheep grazing there, were destroying this natural resource. The U.S. Army was put in charge of that too. I think it's still there now, because of the actions of the Army, which saw these parks as part of our nation and part of what our nation needed, a healthy environment, at least in a couple places. So getting to environmental security from military security is actually nothing new. It's really just an explicit recognition of history and existing military practice. It becomes recognized as such in the 1980s. Before the 1980s, the military worked on a concept called sovereign immunity. They were immune from all the laws and regulations for the environment because the military security was more important. This meant the military's environmental record was frequently awful. I mean, there's a long list of the various despoilations going on. What's more significant here is the change. In 1984, Reagan signs the Defense Environmental Restoration Act, which begins cleaning up military facilities and installations, in other words, placing them under EPA regulations. In 1988, the National Security Strategy of the United States specifically calls environmental degradation a threat to peace and a threat to our national interests. In 1989, Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney introduces the Defense and Environmental Initiative, which says that the military will become a leader in environmental compliance and protection. And even better, it actually does. One of the things that happens is, excuse me, that many military bases are in some cases nature preserves. For example, what keeps LA and San Diego from merging? A bunch of armed Marines, or sorry, Camp Pendleton. Military commanders were put in charge of wilderness preservation and environmental protection for the areas in their bases. Cheney said that the surest way to maintain our access to the air, land, and water we need to maintain and improve our mission capability is to protect these areas. This directly speaks to the idea that the military has the defense of the nation, including the physical natural nature of the nation. 1991's National Security Strategy declares that environment is a security interest and also recognizes that environment can be a cause of international conflict. It's worth noting that in 1991, the world saw two of the most egregious environmental war crimes when Saddam Hussein decided to flood the Persian Gulf with oil in an attempt to clog the intakes on amphibious landing gear, and in his mind also the water and salinization plants of Saudi Arabia further south. He also set fire to hundreds of oil wells, causing one of the great and acute air pollution incidents ever recorded. So we see that traditional military has made a transition to include environment. When about a dozen years ago, the US Navy announces that it is now planning to defend the Arctic Ocean because the ice there is no longer thick enough to keep other ships away, this was not challenged. Its mission wasn't like, oh no, that's not what the Navy's supposed to do. They're like, well, yeah, oceans, you defend them. At first, some of this environmental mission was resisted, even ridiculed. The jokes about the endangered red-cockaded woodpecker at Fort Benning in Georgia were particularly entertaining. But the military commanders basically learned that this was part of their mission, and they have adjusted to that in practice. So, the traditional security model has been criticized. There are alternative views regarding it. And these alternative views are going to come from a group of related critical areas, including the ecological movement, some of the socialist movements, peace movement, and the ecofeminist movement. These alternative approaches do allow for environmental security studies to be the intersection between security and environment. But both of those concepts are claimed to be contested, ambiguous concepts. At the core of what we have is an attempt to redefine what the word security means. The critique of national security-based environmental security creates a sort of gendered duality between the more masculine warrior cult and the earth goddess cult, if you will. To make it clear, this alternative is first defined as not the masculine construction, and given the oppositional logic of a dual nature of gender, that makes it feminine, and additionally openly speaks and claims various values socially constructed as feminine. So first the oppositional. A lot of this critique of the military and the militarization of environment is just intrinsically anti-military. Part of that is based on the much older, at least Cold War period, so 1948 to about 1990 military record, which was, as I already said, awful to worse than that. And occasionally some newer, narrower issue, like you may remember a lot about depleted uranium ammunition, so very specific things that are then added to a list of older environmental sins. The discussion of the change of the last 30 years is largely missing. The other part of the critique of the military is intrinsic. The idea that military, militarism, military thought are in and of themselves a problem to human security. They reject, quote, simple linkages between environment and national security because they feel they could inspire behavior that could deepen global inequality and division. The institutions of national security, which we're talking military, we're talking intelligence agencies, are distrusted in this model. It is this masculine thinking that is ruining the world. So where does this come from? Largely, I'm going to use the word pacifism, but I'm going to toss a couple qualifiers on it. There is principled pacifism. I have met people who are truly nonviolent in every approach that they want to do. It is often based in religion, Buddhist, Quaker, other Christian. It's there. Then we have pacifism as skepticism, someone who disagrees with a specific military role, and rather than sound sort of unpatriotic, they lump it together with the rest of the military and make it a broader critique rather than a specific critique. That's understandable. There's also a sort of fake pacifism, which is being anti-military, but just of one military, usually the U.S.'s, while openly supporting military violence by other groups. So, for example, supporting the Viet Cong, supporting Hezbollah, things like that. Additionally, we see a lot here of a, quote, straw man argument. In other words, mischaracterize and attack the mischaracterization. I found statements in the literature on human security saying the military won't consider the environment. I've got about 4,000 years of contrary evidence. The military is just about short-term solutions. The military is one of the few institutions that our country has that engages in long-term planning. They actually have 20, 30, 40-year time horizons. Congress has about a six-month time horizon, but the military goes longer. There is also the idea of being anti-military as being part of being anti-masculinist. In other words, because the military is constructed as masculine, if one wishes to oppose the masculine, one opposes the military. It connects the military to a model of maleness that's about domination and control and about the use of force. It particularly connects the domination of women to the domination of nature and follows commonalities between those two forms of repression. Ultimately, it defines maleness as being about oppositional relationships. It's a conflict model, whereas femaleness is about interdependency and interconnection and inclusion. Frequently, they will discuss the idea of the ecological lessons of symbiosis, where different species work with each other for everyone's mutual benefit, and other ecological lessons, such as, say, predation, are carefully avoided.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Politics, the Environment, and National Security, with Dr. Lewis Schubert.
So the rebuttal to traditional security is going to have different names. I'm going to use human security, which is probably the most common one. And the idea is to redefine the term security or the concept so that traditional security is essentially marginalized and overwhelmed by a focus on various other social desired issues. There is, of course, a focus on environmental degradation beyond physical harm caused by it or a connection to violence caused by environmental harm, but it also includes health issues, community issues, economic issues, broadly social justice and social equity. In other words, a fairly recognizable progressive menu of social goods. And some of the thinkers, like John Barnett, actually bluntly phrase it that way. Human justice is about social equity. Military justice is about something different and is problematic. Security becomes redefined as freedom from risk of loss or damage to a thing important to survival or well-being. It's a big addition. Richard Ullman wrote that a threat is anything that can quickly degrade the quality of life or inhabitants of a state or a state, and that narrows the choices available to people and organizations within that state. This is a fairly substantial expansion of the word security and the concept of security. Yesterday, I was walking to my home, and my neighbors three doors down just had a baby. That baby will impact their quality of life and will severely curtail the range of choices available to them. It is possible the baby is a security threat. I'm not sure. the goal of the human security movement is to transform the globe into something more sustainable, more equitable, and just. Essentially what it is taking Amartya Sen's concept of human dignity, which is a much older concept, and I will even argue an ancient concept, and relabeling it human security. It gives it different meanings in different cultures, which means one can also avoid exactly defining it because it will mean different things in different places. It largely means a different concept of power, specifically not the national security state. It focuses on ideas of global governance while also having local empowerment. There is strong emphasis on the role of non-state actors, particularly non-governmental organizations, or as we call them in the US, nonprofits. They also make an argument against securitizing issues. So securitizing is essentially taking something and elevating it to the top of the policy discourse, because security comes first, other stuff comes later. It argues against securitizing the environment, but at the same time argues in favor of securitizing this variety of other social issues. And securitization is important. It is that claim to priority within a society and its politics. In one of the writings of Barnett again, they talk about the idea that securitization can justify dramatic and potentially unaccountable action, and that securitizing something means one can bypass democratic barriers to action. Witness, for example, our president's discomfort in having to take action without the full democratic process because he's commander-in-chief and can just do it. There's a different way of thinking about issues when they become security issues. It appears that the human security movement is asserting that calling an issue a security issue, such as education or HIV/AIDS or public health, is actually acceptable and desirable when it is a favored issue, but not when it isn't. Physical security from violent conflict, because of its history and military security, is viewed as suspect. Newer issues are going to be embraced. Please note, this is an open effort to seize the masculinist territory of security in policy and in rhetoric, and substituting favored issues for less favored issues. But the language of security being used is, this is the most important, we're in a rush, we gotta do it now, is a masculinist construction, as they actually decry in terms of environment. It's a disparaging the concept while claiming the concept. If we look at where the debate starts, where there's an explicit debate over environmental security, it begins in the late 1980s. 1980s, if you recall, there was a Cold War, it's winding down. If you want to talk about physical threat, I offer you nuclear war as the greatest example imaginable, the complete destruction of basically everything, planet, people, you name it. With the end of the Cold War, the threat of everybody dying in 20 minutes essentially began to ebb away. It's still out there someplace, but what does the atomic scientists have us at 15 minutes of finally? The other thing that happens after 1990 is the number of physical threats seen in terms of traditional security worldwide plummet. Between 1991 and 94, essentially, the number of civil wars and the casualties of civil wars around the world drops by over three quarters. The number of terrorist attacks and the number of victims of terror drop by over three quarters. And this is largely because these were Soviet-sponsored, and without the sugar daddy, the groups that were doing this violence were not able to continue. So peace breaks out. Now, the concept of security, with the physical security threat so diminished, the concept of security looks like it can be reopened and reexamined. What is at stake is policy priority and, equally important, budgetary priority. In the securitization debate, what militaries want to do is keep both priorities, because they had them. I mean, during the Cold War, the military had the priority. So we see the military in the late 80s and into the 90s beginning to look at environment as an issue, which is a lovely expansion of the priorities and claim to budgetary considerations for the military. But just as the military looks for new ways to justify budget and priority, pretty much everybody and their sister wants to get in on priority status as well. All kinds of new security issues are put forth, health issues, education. Literacy is a national security concern. Population, AIDS, basically almost anyone seeking funding and priority tries to attach the word security to their claim so that they can get part of the post-Cold War peace dividend. Another thing that happens at this time is in the politics of the left, so progressive to further left, there is a period of sort of existential angst as the Soviet Union disappears, as communism is discredited, and there's a question of what now? And in the US and a number of other countries, the progressive left latched on to the environmental issue. Now keep in mind, in 1970, the SDS said Earth Day was a distraction from the class conflict. 20 years later, ooh, we're gonna work with this. The 1990s watch environmental security become part of the discourse. It was a very peaceful decade, and what we, with massive exceptions, Rwanda, Bosnia, but we see environmental security integrating itself into security understanding. The Department of Defense creates an actual undersecretary position for environmental security, Sherry Goodman. The progressive movement begins to use environmental justice as a core focus of its work to help people. And then it changes. And then sort of environmental security doesn't quite drop off the planet, but it drops off the radar in its focus. And this is because two things happen. From the progressive side, you had Seattle in 1999 and the rise of the anti-globalization movement, which is, to one extent or another, a neo-Marxist movement and rekindles the earlier economic focus of the political left. It does include environment. There are turtles as well as Teamsters. But it shifts the focus away from environment and back towards economic matters within the activist core of the left. For the traditional military focus, 13 years ago today was 9/11. And the mass murder of people in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania by Al-Qaeda. That would be called an acute violent threat. And traditional military thinking is very much about dealing with acute violent threats. We had just over a year ago the Boston Marathon bombing. It does continue, and it means that the military focus moved to what it was more comfortable with anyway. So basically, both sides of the debate sort of back off a little bit and go into their comfort zones. It's a breathing period, but there's still environmental threats. They continue to build. So what do we do about this? I believe we're still in the breathing period. I realize that Tom Steyer spoke here two nights ago. He may think that we're past the breathing period. But conceptually, in terms of discourse, I'm a theorist, so I get to do that part, we are still in a breathing period where we're still trying to decide what it is. The issue appears to be that both sides have a resistance to environment because it is this gendered construction that they want and this gendered construction that they cast the other side as. So how do you solve a problem of gender dissonance? Queer theory. So what we have available is what I call queer theory. There are other terms for it. But it's essentially a group of analytical models that expose and, yes, deconstruct incoherencies in supposedly stable gendered conceptualizations. In other words, queering something means to take something and push it into its gender boundaries and do your best to pop through them and end up somewhere else. This happens from both sides. It happens with both genders. Environmental security is a hybrid of warrior culture and, frankly, an earth-based ecological culture. It is both at the same time. How do you explain why hurting trees helps the military? How do you describe why having clean water helps security? These two concepts actually exist together. The conceptual framework seems to be missing. So it is this queer, hermaphroditic concept. So how do we deal with something like that? Well, we have a vocabulary. One queer theorist, Jamaki Highwater, talks about queer theory as being about the transgression of boundaries. Environmental security transgresses boundaries all the time. And the fact that it makes both sides of this critique uncomfortable, I think, is really good, because reality will often challenge our boundaries and demand that we go to some place where there is discomfort. An embrace of both parts of the discourse is needed. You can critique masculinist values. You can critique, and if you want something different than them without rejecting actual facts on the ground, like the fact that environmental issues do lead to acute conflict, and that environment is a necessary part of even the most traditional part of security. It is also important to remember that the, quote, feminine values might distract or detract in a short term from acute immediate deadly threats, but when it comes to actually having to solve them beyond immediate defense, it turns out there's a whole lot being offered here. Concern with broader environmental and human context turns out to be important to our security. I am very hopeful about the resolution of this conceptual debate. And what I see are three developments of the last decade that make me very positive about this. The first is the ability of men and women who are homosexual to serve openly in the military. Here we almost have the idea that queer people are a proxy for queer theory. In other words, the reality on the ground predates the theory catching up with it, which is unusual because usually the theorists are running off ahead of everything. We have gone from dishonorable discharge to don't ask, don't tell, to actually figuring out, and this is one of my favorite quotes on the debate, it's from a guy named Barry Goldwater, and he said, you don't have to be straight to shoot straight. Barry Goldwater was an officer of one of the earliest racially integrated or desegregated units in the Army, and what he found out was Americans come in different colors and can make good soldiers. Maybe lavender might be one of those colors. Since 2011, gays and lesbians have been able to openly serve. This was in part because of the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, where our coalition partners had militaries where gays and lesbians could be serving, and it turns out they made just as fine soldiers as the heterosexuals could. There's also been a change in domestic political attitudes. The second development comes from the now recognition that women deserve a role in combat, that there is a place in combat for women. This is a culmination of a shift of gender roles. We see this actually in the culture leading. We see characters like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We see Sarah Connor in Terminator. We see almost any film with Angelina Jolie, that women are the action heroes. The idea that women are fighting and, you know, kicking ass and all that is not something strange in our culture in any way. One thing we learned in the last decade or so was that women had been serving in combat. Oh yes, they were military police. They weren't assigned to a combat unit. They were with combat units in combat situations, serving with bravery, defending their country, and defending the civilians they were supposed to. We also saw there are distinct advantages to having female combat soldiers mixed in terms of dealing with civilian populations, which include both men and women, apparently. In terms of equity feminism or liberal feminism, equality in the military was an important goal. In the military, you basically need combat experience to get promoted quickly or in some cases even at all. But it's interesting to note that gays got to get into combat openly before women could. In other words, the boundary got pushed, the boundary got queered, and then once it was found that, gee, national security didn't collapse, okay, let's go with the other sex as well. The last one, which I also view as a gender construction issue, and one that I find particularly fascinating, has to do with who served in the military, particularly in the Afghanistan campaign. Most of us are familiar with the old statistic that in Vietnam, the average soldier was 19. The average soldier in Afghanistan was 27 and was a father. The difference in how one approaches a mission, depending on whether one is a 19-year-old teenage boy or 17 to 20-year-old, and whether one is a father, frankly, of any age, but 10 years older makes a difference too, is going to be almost night and day. A father goes into a village and thinks, who do we need to take care of? Because that's what fathers do. They take care of kids. It's part of the job description of being a father. Whereas someone who is not yet at that position, because of, you know, they're only 19, is going to have a more confrontational sort of, you know, let's get on with this fighting stuff kind of idea. So the shift in who is in the military, and the big shift was in Vietnam they were draftees, and in Afghanistan it was an all-volunteer army. That, for me, marks a shift in the gender definition of the military role. So we're seeing that the facts on the ground, so to speak, are leading, if you will, the idea of thinking about what we mean with security. So, more or less to conclude, the military has included environmental concerns into its mission for 30 years now. There was initial reluctance. Environmental protection is now established practice. At one point, the idea of even nation building was viewed as the military getting a mission creep into some sort of soft issue. Today, we recognize that those issues indeed provide security, as evidenced by the surge strategy in Iraq in 2007-2008. Development of economy, education, public health are actually part of the national security mission, and we have proven that now. I believe that the shift in who is serving in the military, particularly gays and lesbians, and women, whether they're lesbian or not, are merely outward signs of a deeper cognitive shift in how we view security. I view that they are the manifestation of a way in which we as a nation have begun to think about things more differently and more broadly, and that we are moving away from a very limited model of the masculine warrior, and we are able to keep that, but also add to it. Okay, we're not throwing one out, we're getting more. The term human security and the human security side of the debate has even tried to capture the term environmental security as theirs. There's a great article by Nicole Dietraz and Michelle Betzel where they basically call what we've so far considered environmental security as environmental conflict, note the negative loaded term, and claiming environmental security is everything else that they want. It's a brilliant rhetorical move. I'm amazed. There's an ongoing effort still to attach the word security and its significance to an ever-widening range of social issues, which, if you think about it, accepts or demonstrates a cognitive acceptance of the priority of the masculine security model. People want in on it. It's not that it should be gotten rid of. People want in on it. They want to have that priority. They want to have that budget. They want to have that sense of importance. They want the share of the action. Deconstruction, which is sort of throughout all this, is finding where something becomes complicit in that which it denounces. That's one of Derrida's many non-definitions for deconstruction. At what point does something become complicit in what it's trying to denounce? At what point did military security become environmental security despite all the jokes about having to guard trees and birds? At what point did the human security or the social justice movement find itself taking on a approach to demand the kind of priority that security entails? We have arrived. Both sides have become complicit in what they denounce. Both sides already engage in this gender hybrid concept called environmental security. Both may protest it, but both are bending the boundaries of their gendered discourses. Environmental security is queer, it's here, and we're getting used to it. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the California Club of the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, Politics, the Environment, and National Security with Dr. Lewis Schubert. We now have time for questions from the audience, and with the mic, I think what I'll do, if you'll put your hand up, I'll come to you, and then I need to return the mic. I don't think that's working. We'll try. So how about the first question? Anyone have a question at this point? Do you have a question for the audience?
So what do you think? Is using gender theory to help better understand and categorize this debate useful? Or are we sucked into essentialism? Ah, here we go. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for your ideas. It seems to me the rear guard action against environmentalism, against equality, gender equality and other kinds, located in states very fundamentalist, mostly in the South, same states who voted for Nixon, et cetera. It seems to me your talk helps understand what they're so angry about. It's a threat to the conceived idea of a bipartite gendered world. What do you think of that?
I think that's a good way of trying to understand it. The change frightens people. Having a conceptual framework that one's comfortable with is a feeling of security in and of itself. It's that warm blanket of knowing that you're right and your worldview is right, and that what's in your worldview is good and just and fair, and that what's on the other side is somehow wrong or deviant. By using this framework, we can, through metaphor, and I realize this is all metaphor, okay, we can talk about something that we're already used to talking about. We as a society have been talking about gender and gender differences for quite a while, okay? We have been talking about the place of gays and lesbians in society for decades already. What we get from gender theory and queer theory is the vocabulary we could use for other concepts that have nothing to do with sex or plumbing or any of that stuff, but are also given gendered identities. So what we have here is basically, I view, a set of conceptual tools that are just sitting there. I mean, I presented this an earlier version of this a couple years ago, and I asked a number of people in the audience, it was a straight academic conference, where should I get this published? And they're like, I don't know. How about like a gay studies journal? This is a national security topic. We're using a tool from a place outside of the normal, you know, methodological tool chest, but we're using it to explore something that is indeed quite distinct and different. One of the things that, you know, I would like to hope is that we can look to see all the possibilities we have in terms of being able to think about things and solve problems and just grab what works rather than having to stick with the tool chest we have.
I have a question. You're talking about the gender metaphor, and I'm a bit of a pessimist in a way, because my sense of things, it's about money and power. Who has the money, who can make more money, and who has the power through that to do what they want to do in the world around us, to people, other people. So my question is, how do you reconcile? Do you reconcile? Do you bring money and power into the argument or to the metaphor?
Well, first, I thought I already did bring money in when I talked about budgetary priorities. Yes, society has ultimately going to have limited resources for different political goals. Which political goals will be addressed and in what order? Part of this debate is to get that priority that comes with security. I don't view this as a bad thing. I mean, politics is about a society trying to determine where to put its efforts in terms of prioritizing what its concerns are. I think that using this gendered approach allows us to get a clearer sense of what actually we're asking. I think that it is necessary to look at the peace movement and the eco-feminist movement and say, you're trying to buy into the game. That's why you're attaching security to everything. I think it's important to tell the military that, you know, your sudden love for endangered species might have something to do with concern about your budget, and not just a deep love for nature and Yellowstone Park and all that. It's an admission of a reality that's already there. And Will there be a competition over it? Yes. That's why this is about priorities. In any human society, the most important political priority is security. Because basically, if you don't have security, you don't have a society. So the contest for what do we plug into that is ongoing. We've spent most of human history worried about immediate attack. So it's sort of taken all the fun out of talking about security because you're just worried about who's coming through the window with a knife or a spear or a gun or something.
So let me continue to be a pessimist. What happens in those areas where people are billionaires and millionaires and have their own cliques or cliques, and they want to stay that way? They want that money for, you know, many, many reasons, mostly from my perspective as power. So I'm not sure that we'll ever overcome that in human history.
I respectfully disagree. Not in terms of that people want to keep what they have, but we also have to remember that everything that we have is a result of having a stable environment. Now, there are some people who love throwing everything up in the air and disrupting it and hoping that everything lands in all right for them. But what it really comes down to is there are certain basics that are needed. And one of those is a healthy, functioning environment so that we have all this air and water stuff that we've become so attached to as a species. Keeping those going is necessary for keeping the status and the status level, the elite level of power of the kind of people you're talking about. And that doesn't have to be a problem.
From the audience.
Thank you, Dr. Schubert. That was very informative and entertaining, too. But the question I'd like to ask is, you mentioned environmental security as if security was the noun and environmental was the adjective. And are we trying to make the environment secure, or are we looking at security as national security? Because in your title you had national security. Now, national security and environmental issues are related, but they're not really the same. And if one fails, the other one will continue to exist. But if the other one fails, the opposite will continue to exist. But it'll be in a totally different time frame. If the human race is wiped out, atomic bombs, whatever, something happens, the Earth will go on and eventually regenerate. Now, is that part of environmental security or not?
Thank you. I understand the idea that the Earth will continue. I'm a fan of James Lovelock, the Gaia hypothesis, that if we're two slime molds and a cockroach, we still have an ecosystem. The reason we talk about national security is nation has a certain definition, and it involves certain people at a certain time doing and living in a certain way. That is necessary in order to understand it. And again, when I talked about why we do it at the national level, is because a nation is a set of shared cultural values, okay? So, I just lost track. What? I'm sorry.
Ecology,
environment, China. Yeah. Here it is. What is the nation? When Phil Sheraton, who knew how to smash the environment as well as any soldier ever has been able to, saw Yellowstone, he was close, he was emotional and upset because he saw his nation, his beloved United States, being despoiled. What is the nation? I mean, Yellowstone, Yosemite are symbols, but in the end, we're down to topsoil, water, okay, forest. This is the actual nation. All that stuff. These are good things. And it is no way something. I mean, picture, you know, I'm thinking, you know, like 4th of July. What do we sing? America the Beautiful. We're like going down our list of our natural resources and being very excited about having them. The idea of defending that thing is intrinsically part of it. When we use the word environmental security, what we're doing is, in fact, reminding people that environment is already and, frankly, has always been part of national security. We're not suddenly making up a new thing, hence all my history lesson stuff.
There was another question.
So you talked about sort of queering the boundaries, especially in regards to gender and sexuality. But what about race and culture? Because first of all, what's your definition of our current nation in regards to our ethnic makeup? And also, how does that impact, you know, working with those boundaries and whether or not different cultures have different ways of viewing like resources, endangered species, food even? Yes.
So first, I'm using it as metaphor, so I'm using gender as metaphor. I'm not trying to displace a different kind of metaphor. The concept, so that's coming to my mind here, is you're saying, well, what if we looked at this in terms of race or ethnicity? We also have in ecology, and most environmental stuff will go back to some ecological, you know, population biology lesson. So symbiosis, you know, parasitism, predation. One of the, quote, lessons that we draw from ecology is diversity is strength. Okay, a healthy ecosystem has a variety of species, so if one of them gets some weird disease, the role is still fulfilled within the ecosystem. In terms of how do I view the United States in terms of race or ethnicity, I view this as a nation that is defined by its diversity. Okay, I view this as American. And as I sometimes tell my students, we're in one of the few countries where the first question people ask is, where are you from? Because we're from here, but what else is there? What else is being contributed from one's heritage and one's background to this greater whole? That is an ecological lesson as well. And that is something that needs to be looked at.
Unfortunately, we have come to that point in our program when that's our final question. We want to thank you all for being here for politics, the environment, and national security. A special thanks to Dr. Lewis Schubert, Professor of Political Science, Social Studies Department, City College of San Francisco. And remember that Dr. Schubert's book, actually the 17th edition of his book, The Irony of Democracy, will be out in December. Our thanks also to Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, for co-sponsoring this program. And our thanks to you, our audience, for being here today, and our radio, television, and internet audiences. Look for all the many Commonwealth Club programs at www.commonwealthclub.org, and check out our radio, video, and free streaming podcasts. And remember, you can find our programs on radio, video, and podcasts, and watch programs on the California Channel Thursday at 9 p.m. and at KRCB-TV Channel 22 on Comcast and DirecTV at 11 a.m., the last Sunday of each month. Subscribe to our free podcasting service to automatically download a new program recording to your personal computer each week. Go to commonwealthclub.org/podcast. And now it is my pleasure to thank again Dr. Schubert for coming tonight. A wonderful, wonderful presentation. I myself learned a lot and really enjoyed the questions and the comments and all the information that you shared with us. We look forward to seeing all of you in this room at our fall environmental programs. And I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.